This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Dr. Paul Bloom, the CEO of Gevo Incorporated. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by Bayer. Stand with American farmers and keep trial lawyers' greed out of our farms and food supply. Fight back at controlweedsnotfarming.com. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Gevo's Dr. Paul Bloom next. Trial lawyers are using a discredited report from a World Health Organization sub-agency to attack a safe American-made weed-fighting tool. This tool helps keep your food costs down, and without it, food inflation could double. Stand with American farmers and keep trial lawyers' greed out of our farms and food supply. Fight back at controlweedsnotfarming.com. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Farmers' hopes for increased crop demand is pinned to increased demand for liquid transportation fuels, including the global airline industry. Gevo CEO Paul Bloom says the company's primary focus is commercializing and scaling a proven alcohol-to-jet pathway to make aviation fuel. Bloom says the renewable fuel industry's potential continues to grow.
Jeff, if you followed this space for probably the past 20 years, you know it's always been a push and a pull, back and forth. But I think the one thing that we've seen more now than ever is the need to diversify feedstocks and have, you know, security of supply from different sources, not just petroleum, but things like renewable fuels. There's a big need for that. I think the ethanol industry has proved that with how successful it's been in delivering, you know, octane components to every gallon and helping the U.S. consumer have low cost. So that's been one. And so we want to bring that now not only to on-road, but in the air as well as we commercialize the alcohol-to-jet technology to produce jet fuel.
There are lots of companies now that are making ethanol. It consumes a tremendous amount of feedstock every year in terms of bushels of corn. How is Gevo different in the molecular process and especially in the area of isobutanol?
Yes. Yeah, so we've got a number of technologies, Jeff. On the isobutanol front, I'll start with that. It's basically when you're making ethanol, you're running a fermentation process. You use a yeast. When we make isobutanol, we actually use a yeast. It's very similar. We've just engineered that yeast. Instead of making ethanol, we make isobutanol. The rest of the fermentation process is very similar. The difference is you get a 4-carbon alcohol instead of a 2-carbon alcohol, and those properties are a little bit different. So it has higher flash point, for example. It has higher energy density. So there are a few things with that isobutanol. But then, you know, the interesting part is we're seeing it's not one versus the other. We really see those coming together to provide optionality to the market. So we produce ethanol today at Gevo, North Dakota. We're seeing more interest in India, actually, for isobutanol production today. In India, they want to, and they're looking hard at this, is to put isobutanol as a diesel blend stock. So there's not a lot of oil seeds in India. So instead, using carbohydrates like corn, rice, sugarcane, molasses as feedstocks, really to make a diesel blend stock seems like a really unique idea. And to help them with their energy security needs in India. So the isobutanol technology is still there. We actually turn isobutanol into isooctane, which is a high-quality, high-octane component, the hydrocarbon component. We actually sell that into the racing fuel market today as well. So a lot of different optionality that we have to provide these kind of components. You know, one of the things that we love about ethanol is it's got great high-octane, but you know, it has about 76,000 BTUs per gallon. So the energy density is a little bit lower than gasoline. What we're really trying to do with our alcohol to jet technology to turn ethanol into jet fuel is really a chemical process that we run on this to densify energy, right? So we densify that. We turn ethanol actually into a drop-in product that looks just like jet fuel, synthetic paraffinic kerosene. And we densify that energy from 76,000 BTUs to 135,000 BTUs per gallon. Because, as you know, you can't just stop your jet and fill up at the gas station anytime you want. So we need to pack energy-dense liquids on the wing of the aircraft. But really, all those benefits that we've seen the industry develop around the ethanol industry, we think we can leverage those into production of jet fuel.
I noted from the products that come from Gevo listed renewable gasoline and low-carbon ethanol. Can you explain how these are similar and the difference that you might have to other companies?
So low-carbon ethanol, a lot of companies are producing low-carbon ethanol, but probably not as low as what Gevo is doing. We're actually, in our ethanol process, we run a process called carbon capture and sequestration in North Dakota. Been doing this since 2022 when it was actually Red Trail Energy. We acquired it last year. And now we named it Gevo North Dakota. We're not too creative when it comes to naming, but we're actually for every ton of fuel we produce about a ton of carbon dioxide in the fermentation process, and that carbon dioxide that comes out of the fermentation process, we capture that and then we sequester it in a deep well in the right geology under the plant. And that actually helps decrease the carbon intensity of the final ethanol, along with a lot of other process improvements that we're doing. Really, you think about that carbon intensity and low carbon as doing more with less, right? So it's all about how do we make it more efficient, and then we have great process, but then we remove CO2 as well through CCS, and that's really gives us that low carbon ethanol that we then sell into low carbon fuel markets. Or we can actually take those carbon credits that we develop and sell them into new and nascent markets like carbon dioxide removals. These are new things that we're doing, but I think the ethanol industry is well positioned to take advantage of these new low carbon markets across the board.
Let's touch sustainable aviation fuel. I've had the opportunity to speak to two different airline companies about this, and they show that they are definitely interested because they want to do their part in being more sustainable. But they also mentioned that SAF is expensive, and they see the need for tremendous amounts of tax breaks, either through the state, through the federal, to be able to make a fuel that will cash flow in their operations. Is this a challenge that you see, or has Gevo come up with a better process that will make your fuel more price competitive for the airline industry?
You have to think about, you know, this from the very beginning. Can I make something on the fuel side that is competitive as possible? And that's where we're pretty excited about our ability to produce a fuel today that we think is on a cash cost basis competitive with Jet A. You know, anything around $100 a barrel of petroleum, we think that cash cost of production is competitive. The difference is we have a brand new capital investment that we have to pay off, right, in order to get that competitive product out there. So how do you compete with a lot of fully depreciated assets out there in the market? That's where some of the incentives, things like 45Z and other incentives come in that can really help with these new capital investments that need to be made to get these products going. And as you know, 45Z is set to expire in 2029. You know, those kind of timelines, when we're starting to build a new plant, that we need a time horizon that's longer than that to help with those capital investments.
Okay, so this is a heavy lift, but let's just for a moment in our conversation put legislation and regulation to the side, and let's just talk about potential demand from the liquid transportation fuel for cars and trucks, for the airline industry. Is the glass half full or half empty?
We see a big opportunity coming, Jeff. The U.S. is going to need about 2.3 billion gallons of additional jet fuel by 2035. So in 2035, where is that 2.3 billion gallons of additional jet fuel going to come from? People are flying more, not less. You know, every time you build a new refinery, we're actually shutting down more refineries than building new refineries. And even if you did, only 9% of that barrel turns into jet fuel. So we think that turning ethanol into jet fuel is really the answer here to meet that fundamental demand for jet fuel. Notice I didn't say SAF or synthetic aviation fuel. I just said jet fuel, because that's first and foremost what we think about is how do we provide that commodity that the U.S. consumer needs. And we think that this is a really good fit. Then we can start talking about all the other benefits. That's the commodity piece. We always think about how do we sell the commodity, and then how do we provide the environmental attributes or the carbon benefits that are also we're focused on delivering, like what we talked about from the carbon capture and sequestration, which can either be included with that fuel or sold separately into the market. I'm pretty optimistic about our ability to leverage U.S. agriculture to use the improvements of that farmers are making to improve yields on every acre, and then all the efficiency gains that we've had in the ethanol industry. That sets us up to use low carbon ethanol as the base for really, as we see a growing new industry for SAF or, you know, renewable jet fuel.
I would assume when you say alcohol to jet, you're talking primarily about corn, or are there other feedstocks that will suffice?
We think about this on a global basis. So carbohydrate feedstocks in general, Jeff, will work. Anything that you can run through the fermentation process. So that could be corn, obviously lowest costs, you know, most prevalent feedstock that we're looking at in the United States. That's our primary feedstock. But globally, you look at places like India and South America, obviously sugarcane molasses, all those feedstocks are fair game too. Rice, and then you even start to get into things like wood and wood wastes, all carbohydrates, all can be fermented. It's just a matter of what's going to be the lowest cost to get you there, and then what are the environmental attributes and what does the customer actually want to make it possible. But we've got flexible feedstocks on a global basis, which is going to really be a regional choice.
So the alcohol to jet is different than those that would use soybean oil or use cooking oil as a base to satisfy the airline industry.
That's correct. Most of those processes go through a conversion technology called HEFA. And the vegetable oil basically to jet fuel, you're using what's called a hydrotreating process. We're using a different chemistry connection, both to turn ethanol first and foremost into a compound called ethylene. So we go through a different step, make it there, and then we oligomerize it. So we build up a chain to make synthetic paraffinic kerosene. So it's a different process, but we start with ethanol, two carbons, and end up with jet fuel, which typically is a 12 to 16 type carbon chain length.
So now let's bring the gorilla back in the room, and we'll start from the regulatory process, from the Department of Revenue for tax policy to the Environmental Protection Agency for RVOs and small refinery exemptions, and the rest. First, I would have to believe that you're pleased with higher RVO numbers from the EPA, but I don't know that the two-year window is enough to satisfy those who would want to invest in this industry.
Yeah, Jeff, you're exactly right. So we're in this for the long run, and right now we're trying to get our financing done for what we call serial number one or Project North Star to turn ethanol into jet fuel in North Dakota. So that process is ongoing today. Then it's going to be about a 2.5 to 3 year window for us to actually complete the construction of that facility. You mentioned the RVO. So it is interesting, and we're optimistic because, you know, we saw even things like D4 RINs increase substantially. And the way it sits now, we would expect that the jet fuel that we'd make is very similar to diesel, but would qualify under a D4 RIN. So we like where that's going with a higher D4s that were put out there. But yeah, the timing is the real factor here for us, right? So since we're planning to be in, it would take 3 years from today if we had our financing going. That window, we really need to see that shift and become a longer time horizon for us.
For this to grow, for this segment of industry and of fuel to grow, what do you need from Washington?
One, I think the recognition that we've got diverse sources of, you know, energy here, and that this is really a key piece of our energy security policy. I think we've seen it more than ever with the events in Iran that, you know, price kind of impacts everybody, but making sure that we can have strong domestic supply and increased domestic supply from agriculture as continued yields from every acre improve. But we think this is the fundamental key thing that we need to support. That turns into then, you know, what kind of policies do we need? We love 45Z. We like where it's going. Again, with 45Z expiring as it sits today in 2029, that doesn't help us a whole lot when we're investing in plants that are going to be around for the next 50 years. And so we really want to see, you know, longer term support for this industry that we can rely on. And at the other component of 45Z, I know that people are discussing today is how do the farmers benefit? And so we really think that this, the improvements that we're seeing in agriculture need to count. And so including those ag benefits in 45Z so farmers can participate, that's a key thing for Gevo. We've got a business called Verity where we actually track all the sustainability and things at the farm level. This is critical that those farmers can get rewarded and participate. And because economic sustainability has to go hand in hand with environmental sustainability. So all of this needs to wrap together to have successful policy here.
Your plants won't be built by the time that the current rules run out in Washington.
That's absolutely correct. So, you know, we're not banking on that as long term, but you know, those are the kind of things that we really see the commodity value, the carbon value, and then whatever we can maximize on incentives is, you know, how we support our projects. We see a real value here in this growing carbon market that, you know, it's still nascent, but that's a key component for us as we start to grow. You know, how do we sell fuel and the environmental attributes really either together or separately? But we see policy, you know, for low carbon fuel markets, there's stackable benefits here. Right? So we think about that commodity value as the underlying component. Then we go to the carbon value, which, you know, whether it's the airlines or the airlines customers, there's something called scope 3 emissions. And those scope 3 credits are things that companies are buying to basically help minimize their environmental liabilities. And so they're buying those carbon credits that we can produce along with the fuel. And then, you know, then we think about the incentives, whether they're state level tax incentives, 45Z tax incentives. But again, we think about that stack that's required to make the equation work for us so we can get these plants supported long term.
Well, sustainability was the word that we brought in several years ago, and now we have a phrase called regenerative agriculture, and your company stands by that. I'm anxious for your definition. From the view of Gevo, what is regenerative agriculture, and if that's employed to provide feedstocks for your company, how do you define it?
I think the most important thing is when you use carbon intensity as a proxy, a lot of other good things happen. And regenerative agriculture is a really good example of this. And so I would just simply define regenerative agriculture is agriculture that does more with less. And we've seen this in practice, Jeff. We've been doing this now for about 5 years with farmers, really great farmers who are using things like no-till and strip-till farming practices. They're using cover crops. They're using ag biologicals. So they're doing a lot of these different practices that would all fit under regen ag. And ultimately, they're using less fertilizer. They're getting higher yields. They're you know, using less fuel to drive through their fields. So, and the other component is they're actually building carbon stocks back in the soil. So while we talked about carbon capture and sequestration, we also see regen ag building this carbon stock in the soil. And you can say, well, great, what does that do for me? Well, it actually makes the soil more healthy. And the one thing that we're not making any more of in this country is land. So regenerative agriculture, to me, is a way that we're making a more productive asset, right? And these are every acre that farmers are farming today. We've seen them when they're using the regen ag practices. They're making that a more productive asset, a healthier soil, more resilient to extreme weather events, better resistant to erosion. So all the right things that you want to see, which ultimately, think about it, how do we get better feedstocks long-term, lower cost, be the best in the world at producing these things? That's why we think that the U.S. farmer is really the key and the base of what we need to support for our business. And that's why, you know, ethanol to jet technology really is going to be a winner because of everything the farmers are doing.
Well, Paul, let's talk about today and the size of your company and your output today. And what do you see the potential for your company and for this industry?
Jeff, today we're focused on producing our low carbon ethanol and CO2 co-products at Gevo, North Dakota. We've got a renewable natural gas facility in Northwest Iowa where we're producing about 400,000 MMBTUs of renewable natural gas from dairy manure. We're monetizing all those products today. And, you know, going forward, obviously, we talked a little bit about the expansion of Gevo, North Dakota, but it's not just Gevo, North Dakota expansion. We're going to be adding on the alcohol to jet technology. We got to get to serial number one with our ATJ 30. But that really opens up and demonstrates that we can not just do this at Gevo, North Dakota. We can do this at all the ethanol plants in the country. I'm very excited about some of the partnerships that we're forming with companies like Frontier. Frontier is helping to connect virtual pipelines for CO2 by rail to carbon sequestration, which enables more ethanol companies to be to have low carbon ethanol, which again sets the table for, you know, us to put more alcohol to jet plants in place. You have to remember we're focused on a modular approach. So we can build these modules and the alcohol to jet plant that we can set next to existing ethanol infrastructure. And we want to continue to grow that business. You got to have the low carbon ethanol. You got to have the right energy to power the plant, and you got to have the right technology. We think we've got all of that. So we're very optimistic that we can meet the demands of, you know, the aviation industry, both from a commodity, the actual fuel, and from the carbon attributes that are needed to decarbonize a hard to decarbonize segment of the market.
Well, Paul Bloom, we want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us on this edition of Open Mic. It's exciting news. This is Open Mic, and today the guest gets the last word.
Thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate you having us on today. You know, it's an exciting time for us because, you know, as you've heard, we've got a lot of optionality. It starts with low carbon ethanol. It starts with renewable natural gas. We've put these existing businesses together. We've got a lot of technology we can layer on top. De-risk technology, right? This isn't stuff. This isn't a science project anymore. This is ready for prime time. So now it's about getting the investments, getting this stuff to commercial reality, and, you know, helping out the U.S. consumer and providing low carbon fuels that are cost effective.
Our thanks to this week's guest, Dr. Paul Bloom, CEO of Gevo Incorporated, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by Bayer. Stand with American farmers and keep trial lawyers' greed out of our farms and food supply. Fight back at controlweedsnotfarming.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nelly.